Hey guys, this is the Worldview Podcast. I'm your co-host, Arnav Day, and I'm here with Azib and Nishan, and we'll be hosting this episode for you. How's it going, y'all?
Yeah, good, man. Good.
What about you?
Yeah, going good, man.
Yeah, all good.
Yeah, lockdown has been hella boring for all of us, so we thought we'd engage in a few interesting discussions on topics we all enjoy. And today is a similar, it being our first episode, we wanted to tackle something I think very important and something that we all should explore from all perspectives. And this is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It has been one of the most destructive and devastating conflicts in recent history. And it has only been fueled by a cycle of hate and destruction. So on that note, we thought we would discuss this topic. And this discussion is going to revolve more around the causes of the conflict and the development of the conflict. So therefore, we more than just giving an evaluation on the justness of the Palestinian cause or the Zionist cause, we want to talk about why the conflict is happening and therefore the different factors that contribute to the same. So in that regard, think of it like this. If we were to visualize the conflict, instead of Israel-Palestine, think of, on a more general sense, these two countries as nations pursuing their self-interest. In any nation, forget a nation, it could be a person, our interest maximizes, self-interest maximizes. And in the world, there is no situation where one can seek out his or her interest without threatening the interest of anybody else. And in the same way, conflict occurs when the interests of one nation or political entity undermines the interests of another. And it has been a truism in politics and society that there can never be a scenario where this trade-off does not exist. And therefore, the discussion is more about what we can do to minimize conflict and to have a better state of affairs in the world and in any political scenario. And with that, we will start discussing about the political dimensions of this conflict and why it's so intense as it is today.
So in essence, one must understand that there are several themes across both these countries that quite literally fuel their conflict. I mean, it's not that Palestine and Israel don't have their differences. It's obviously the fact that they do have the distinctive factors of them rising and the radicals part of each other's conflicts. But the interlining and also the factors in between each of them are quite interesting. The first thing that should probably be brought up is the fact that conflict as a whole, which is symbolized by the continuous wars and insurgencies and guerrilla attacks that both these countries have conducted against each other, have really transformed their domestic political environment. I mean, if you can, I'd like you to think about in Israel after independence for about nearly 30 years, they were under a left-wing government, a socialist government that was relatively secular and nationalist, but did not really have a very clear path for the view towards Palestinians. I mean, the founder of Israel, arguably, apart from Theodore Herzl, was David Ben-Gurion, and he himself said that he would give Palestinians an Arab citizenship in Israel. Yet it was his Mapai and Rafi parties that oversaw not only the liberation war, but also the Fedayeen insurgency, as well as the Suez Canal crisis, which involved other Arab nations as well. So the left in this chance never really had a clear view for Palestine. On top of that, I mean, Ben-Gurion being a socialist atheist did not help with trying to moderate or control the Jewish conservatives and those who wanted a hard line against Palestine. And ultimately, Labour really only took a side in this debate until they signed the Oslo Accords under Yitzhak Rabin. So their stance is really, really obscured in a sense. Whereas Likud in its time was quite firm and dominant in what it believed in. And this was seen right after the 60 war and the Yom Kippur war. I mean, in the Six-Day War, there was overconfidence from the Israeli Defense Force because they won. And in the Yom Kippur War, they almost lost because of this overconfidence. And as a result of this, Likud used this conflict to almost politically bargain that the left was not secure enough to deal with Palestine. And it came to power with its pro-Israel and pro-defense policies. And it governed under a very hardline approach under Menachem Begin. It took a strong, firm stance on resettlements. It made Jerusalem the capital of Israel. And it made it a very, very hardline government that would exploit conflict. And ultimately today, what you see, even in Palestine, where Fatah came to power as a result of its guerrilla tactics, and it too also used conflict to come to power. And ultimately, Hamas itself also used conflict as to come to power in the form of the intifadas as well as its rocket attacks in the Gaza Strip. And what we're seeing even today in the recent attacks in Israel. So what we have to understand is that, unfortunately, the wars that have been fought in history have really propelled extremes to come out in both these countries. Mm-hmm. Another theme that I believe was very important to understand is that there's a very, very clear chance that the peacekeepers, the people that have almost bargained for peace in this conflict, have utterly failed in this issue, very frankly and sadly. The Labour government that obviously signed the Oslo Accords ended up backfiring for them because as they signed the Oslo Accords, they threw away their sense of defense and nationalism. They threw away their promise that they would protect the Israeli people because here they are signing a pact with the enemy almost to the Israeli people. And ultimately, the accords meant nothing because you had the first and second, you had the first intifada in the 90s and you had the second intifada in the early 2000s. And then you also had Hamas. So Labour completely fell apart into tatters despite supporting the two-state solution. And you had far-right parties, not just Likud, but Shas, you had United Torah Judaism, you had the moderate party, Beninwa, the blue and white party under Benny Gantz, even agreeing with Likud on the policy of having a hawkish approach to Palestine. And the main reason for this is because peace, which is what the left has always preached from Yesh Atid to the Labour, have all preached peaceful solutions with Israel, which unfortunately have failed. And the people ultimately reflect their vote into supporting the hawkish policies of not just Likud, but mainly Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu, who's come to power on a stringent policy against Palestine. I mean, for a man that declared all Arabs to be evil and terrorists, for a man to be accepted like that goes to show that there's been a very big political shift in the Israeli paradigm. There's been a shift in the Overton window in Israel. You know, people believe that if you took a hawkish stance against Palestine, you were a religious extremist, you were a hawk, and you were someone that could not be trusted. But here we are today, where Likud is still in power today as a result of using the fear of annihilation. It's instilled into the people the sense that Israel is under attack. It's not just Palestine, but, you know, Lebanon and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and they'll all come for Israel one day. And it's important that Israel is able to defend itself. And so, you know, despite having shaky coalitions and political governments, Netanyahu has stood the wave of time and he's remained in power because he's used conflict to stay in power. And his ideology has become far more acceptable to the Israeli people. And ultimately, on top of that, as the Israeli people have seen, peace is no longer an initiative and it's no longer an option to be considered. Another thing that I would add on the Palestinian side is they too have followed the same principles. Fatah, that signed the Oslo Accords, ultimately did not see much welfare come up in the West Bank. The Muslim Brotherhood, which was Fatah's biggest enemy, got permission from Israel to, you know, sign up in Gaza, which is ironic because the fact that Israel allowed the Brotherhood to stay in Gaza ultimately resulted in Yasin forming Hamas and eventually becoming a political extremist and attacking Israel. But ultimately, Fatah failed in defending peace, and Fatah also did not uphold the conditions of the Muslims in Palestine. And ultimately, what it resulted in is, again, Fatah not being seen as true Arabs because they sighed for peace. And they were not seen as a politically capable party or an organization. Hamas, on the other hand, which justified its anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic approach through the fact that Israel continued to resettle Israelis into Palestinian lands. It also, the IDF's atrocities in the recent Hamas retaliation strikes as well as the Intifadas, it was able to justify its political platform through conflict, very similar to how Likud did it. And in the end, with the failure of Fatah, as well as the Overton window making Hamas seem far more approachable as a radical force, you see two sides which are hell-bent on fighting one another and destroying one another, because to them, to each other, they have caused immense suffering. Peace is no longer an option. And ultimately, the people believe in their rhetoric. And with that, I would like to invite questions from my co-hosts as to this political environment.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. In fact, you know, the whole idea that Ben Gurion on the left would say that, oh, this is a state for the Jews, but we will be secular in accepting other citizens. And even the Fatah, I think the Palestinian National Authority, are still a secular nationalist, but they didn't necessarily say that, you know, we would reject other communities. But then they was, I mean, despite that, I mean, it seems to be a paradox in their view. I say, oh, a state for the Jews, but we are also secular. There are some parallels, I guess, with India-Pakistan. I mean, the fact that Pakistan was partitioned and Muhammad Ali Jinnah had said, oh, I want a state for the Muslims, but we should also be secular because we feel that a Muslim majority state is more capable of being secular. I think that was his reasoning. Similar reasoning here, but then still, despite that, the radical forces or the more right-wing forces, they have greater influence. Even though, so this is, it seems like a pattern, unfortunate pattern, you know, like must be some source of that fact, you know, nations trying to be secular on a nationalist foundation or on a foundation like the Israelis or like in Pakistan. Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. What do you guys think about that?
I'm thinking about the international implications of it still. Like, when we're talking about the inter-Pakistan conflict, it's the entire thing that their war, like, I agree what you say when Nehru and Jinnah formed India and Pakistan respectively, that they wish to remain relatively secular and they wanted to include people from other communities as well. But when you look at it now, it seems like both nations are inadvertently at each other's throats for a series of reasons. But when I look at the Israel-Palestine conflict, I find it very confusing relatively, because on one hand, you have Israel, which has a legitimate and recognized government. And on the other hand, in Palestine, you have the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which are kind of divided and under different political rule, with the West Bank being under the Fatah, but the Gaza Strip being under Hamas. And Hamas sharing this very complex identity to itself, because internationally, its recognition is really mixed. You have the United States of America, Canada, Japan, and the entire European Union recognizing Hamas as an entire terrorist organization, be it the political or the military wing of it. You have other nations recognizing it, predominantly the United Kingdom, that recognize only the military branch as a terrorist outfit, but Hamas, like the political wing that fought the elections as a legitimate government. And then you have nations like Russia, China, and Iran that entirely recognize Hamas, both the political and the military wing. So in some perspective, Hamas is either seen as a government body over a certain area or seen as a non-state actor in the Gaza Strip. That I feel makes this conflict a lot more complicated, because if it were two governments going head to head, it would end up implying things that are a lot simpler. But when you look at a government going up against what many recognize as a non-state actor, international law, treaties aren't exactly applicable on it anymore. And then getting on to the fact that initially the people who signed the Oslo Accords were the Labour Party in Israel and the Fatah from Palestine, but now you have their opposite party, the one that opposed the Oslo Accords, in power currently. Sean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is the main problem which we see in Israel, is that the Overton window has resulted in an extremely different policy set. I mean, even Menachem Begin, when he was in power also, was not very, very certain about, you know, having to sign any peace agreement with Palestine. It agreed with having some kind of neutrality with it. I mean, that's how you saw with how under Menachem Begin's regime, he signed an agreement with Egypt, making Egypt the first Arab country to actually recognize Israel. So there were attempts on their accord also to, you know, go ahead and sue for peace, but not necessarily the same peace that Labour were going to. I mean, Netanyahu has been very clear that he is extremely opposed to the Oslo Accord. And the problem is that despite being in a very shaky coalition, I mean, the Israeli political system is not what we are here to discuss, but the political system in Israel is very intricate and complex. And what it's resulted in is that there are various parties with various political agendas. You know, some are very moderate and appeal for a two-state solution similar to Yesh Atid and Labour. Others are very moderate and believe in some firm action like the Blue and White Party. And then there are some very hawkish parties like Likud, Shas, and United Torah Judaism, who all believe that, you know, there should be resettlement of the Palestinians, that Judaism and Jerusalem must fall under Israeli bounds. And, you know, Palestinians are quite literally and unfortunately deemed to be terrorists by these parties. So it does not help that the opposition to such ideas, which is the left, is in complete tatters. You know, there's no structure to them. There is no coalition. There's no alliance. It's just one party is there from the left. The other parties there from the left, they may even share the same ideas. It's similar to how in India, a lot of the center left to left-wing parties share similar ideas, whether it be secularism or peace with Pakistan or anything like that. But the problem is they have differences of political ego and issues that simply result in their opponents being able to build up strength and retaining power. It's a similar thing that you can see here in Israel, where Likud has literally no formidable opposition. It has no constructed and solid foundation of an opposition. It's quite literally uncontested. And its main opposition, ironically, came from the right, which was Benny Gantz, who was in the Blue and White Party. But he got him on his side after the attacks. And the biggest problem is that with these recent attacks in April, it's just going to justify their doctrines, you know, where they're just going to continue looking towards hawkish policies. And the shift is only going to continue, unfortunately, towards a more violent path as a result of, I think, a lot of factors.
Right. And I think what's interesting is that the source of the conflict is with the fact that the political vision of each country or how they view each other is tilting towards a right-wing module. And that's happening possibly because I think, as we've been discussing, the leftist view of the situation is lowering in prominence. Although that was the founding view of the country. Israel was led by a Labour government, as Ishan said, for a long time. And what's kind of ironic is, it seems like how Adib was saying, the countries view Hamas as a non-state actor, because they're not as reasonable. The fact, I think, generally speaking, the Palestinian population is fairly supportive of Hamas, despite its extremist origins. And the fact that that's true, I think we have that just gives a signal that these radical right-wing ideas about nationhood and about the political reality is gaining more traction because of the inherent paradoxes in the leftist. Let's look at it from the psychological perspective. So, I mean, and this comes back to the contradiction between having these contradiction in Israel, where you say you have a state for the Jews, but you try to be secular. In that sense, the average citizen, for the average Palestinians, they see Israel as an occupying power, and they have been an occupying power. And the fact that they don't have basic rights and they are denied basic human rights and they live under constant surveillance 24/7, they don't have the freedom for mobility and they face institutional discrimination. With all these factors in mind, you can imagine a Palestinian being utterly disillusioned with the current state of affairs, wherein he's unable to express his own political identity as a Palestinian. And all that sort of amalgamates into this dislike for the enemy. So in this sense, Palestinians certainly it does create the schism between the Israelis and Palestinians in terms of how they view each other. And the view is largely influenced by how much they're exposed to. For the average Palestinian, they are exposed to the Israeli soldier who has power over them. And there have been several events and violent clashes between the Israeli soldiers and West Bank Palestinians. That shapes their view of the Israelis. For the Israelis, their view of the Palestinians are simply shaped by the news continually speaking about suicide bombings and Hamas rockets being intercepted. In this closed information environment, there's obviously a kind of mutual dehumanization. The side simply cannot understand the other side and only sees the other side as wanting to destroy them. In such an environment, when the left parties say that we want a secular, or they look for a peaceful approach, they gravitate towards a peaceful approach. It seems the environment simply does not allow for such, and the people will be quite shocked because, I mean, they have a different view of the enemy. And because they have such a, because their view is so formulated by the media environment and, the limited interactions with the other side, they are more akin to follow the right-wing views of the country. For Israel, for example, this is particularly true when we look at the voting patterns as studied from the 90s onwards. I mean, Ishan did mention the rise of the Likud and Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Overton window shift can be seen through changing Israeli voting patterns in the late 90s, wherein the metric of security became far more important metric for deciding electoral success in the late 90s after the Intifadas. But the Israeli people were more concerned with security, and because, as I mentioned, the Israeli media and their influence in Israeli society, Israelis consume more per capita of the media than any place in the world, and the media is heavily in conduct with the government as well. Therefore, what they portray is strictly under the influence of what the government wants it to portray. And having the right-wing ecosystem now, they're constantly fed this anti-Palestinian rhetoric. And that creates a toxic right-wing atmosphere in the minds of the Israelis and in the minds of the Palestinians living in West Bank, living in Gaza, who simply don't know beyond the basic facts that they are being oppressed, or they are being, their existence is at question because of this opposing side, and that it's a zero-sum game. That is the biggest problem here, I think, that they just cannot believe that one can exist with the other, that coexistence is even a possibility. And the environment as such has promoted this kind of thinking. And that is a vicious cycle. Because if one side does not believe in the possibility of coexistence itself, can I expect violence and conflict to stop or sort of level out anytime soon? These are toxic psychological environments that are created by the politics, as mentioned here. And I think that can also be connected even to the international scenario, wherein I think the international treatment of Israel and Palestine. I think, what do you guys think about other aspects of the conflict besides the psychological?
I think that's a really interesting point you bring up. And man, and I think another thing that we need to also remember that, like, you know, it's not like these parties have come to power just on the fact that they want to go to war with the other. They've also done some good work. I think it would be wrong to ignore that. I mean, Likud has brought some of the most advanced economic growth to Israel in a while. I mean, they're hitting magical numbers on the GDP growth, and they've done some really good educational reforms and also healthcare reforms. People, you know, are from the age of three. So, you know, from almost a child, you are granted so many rights from a right-wing party, no less. You know, the common norm is that, you know, most of the left-wing parties enable social welfare, but Likud's not done that. Likud doesn't follow that. They've done some very good social reforms, and they've projected themselves on an economic chart that makes them be trusted by the people. So people ultimately then trust Likud for other issues, and they basically trust in Likud's judgment on other issues. And this is something that Adib was bringing about, how there's been a shift from the policy, from how the left's policies are shifted to the right. And this is exactly what Likud has done. It is basically, it's almost capitalized on these policies from that the left initially wanted to implement. The left wanted to implement free healthcare, free education, welfare for all Israelis. The right has done it. And this has projected them to be better party leaders and better leaders of the government, to the point that, you know, they will be trusted to handle such issues of defense and security also. And on top of that, in Palestine also, you'll see Hamas in Gaza also did some good work in making, under Yasin, their founder's leader, they did some decent work in actually creating healthcare, enabling community centers, and actually allowing for Muslims to have an easier life in Gaza, which is obviously not an easy thing to do because Gaza obviously is under some kind of Israeli administration to this day. So these parties have almost camouflaged their policy and agenda through good governance. You could call it good governance in a sense that they have delivered on certain promises to the people. And the people, as a result, then begin to trust them and they give them their vote. And in turn, they get the power to be able to conduct whatever they want when it comes to, you know, the defense and national security issues. So that is why I think also when you were mentioning the statistic on how security is the biggest metric, it's because of the fact that things such as economic growth and social welfare have already been taken care of. So that just shows the amount of trust that they have where, you know, it's like, we believe in you. We know you're going to do a good thing for society. That's why we don't really worry about these metrics. We believe in this metric of national security. Assure to us that you can do it. So that is, I think, a big thing there also.
Also think about this conflict and what it means for the international community, because it's not that easy picking a side for international countries. But like assuming the fact that you are relatively neutral, then picking a side is easy. But for majority of the Western bloc, like the US, Canada, the European Union, it's not that simple to simply condemn Israel in the light of recent events, because first and foremost, these nations, if they condemn Israel, it means they're supporting Palestine, which is, as they themselves have declared, being currently governed by a terrorist organization. So it creates a paradox for international politics. On one hand, the Western bloc does not know whether they should support Israel so as to maintain their relations with Israel and to continue their stance or their aggressive policy on Hamas, which they have recognized themselves as a terrorist outfit, or if they want to side with Palestine, which is going to be aggravating Israel or kind of breaking a sort of trust factor between Israel and the respective nation, it means supporting human rights and the human rights violations that are currently we're witnessing. But for these countries, it also means a departure from their policy of recognizing Hamas as a terror outfit. And with the recent shift in European and American politics, with the rise of xenophobia, with the rise of Islamophobia, and a relatively more strong-handed nature when it comes to dealing with terror outfits, supporting Palestine becomes a very complicated matter for them. And for the US and for other Arabic nations, this conflict is complicated further by the fact that Iran, as this very relatively speaking rogue nation, is directly funding and supporting Palestine. So the Arab League or the Gulf Committee Council, the GCC, predominantly has a kind of unspoken or agreed upon exclusion of Iran as a nation. So when Iran ends up sending a massive amount of aid, military, economic, and other forms of aid to Palestine, for the Gulf nations to directly condemn Israel becomes difficult, because that means, in a way, siding with Iran. And Iran lately has been making very strong pleas for Palestine and has been advocating a very strong anti-Israel sentiment for within the Middle Eastern nations. So going ahead and directly condemning Israel becomes complicated for these Arabic nations, because they want to continue excluding Iran and not give Iran their support. But on the other hand, they would be and have historically supported Palestine. So it creates a bit of a conflict for them. And as we see over the last few years, it's been evident that they're prioritizing excluding Iran over supporting Palestine. Like last year, it was, I believe, UAE and Bahrain that ended up signing a normalized a pact with Israel that essentially ended their turmoil of extremely sour relationships, international relations, and kind of normalized it. So we're seeing this gradual recognition of Israel. Earlier it was Egypt and Jordan that did it, and now UAE and Bahrain are doing it as well, wherein they are recognizing Israel in what I assume would be an attempt to further isolate Iran. But then by recognizing Israel and by normalizing relations with it, it's indirectly indicating a shift in their policy, that they're going to prioritize their own interest over the current condition in Palestine. And it's been very recent news that Iraq, there have been protests going on in Iraq also for a stronger anti-Iran sentiment after terror outfits affiliated with the Iranian government have been conducting killings across cities in Iraq. So protests are currently going on in Iraq where the people are protesting against the government and pushing forward a stronger anti-Iran sentiment. And if the government ends up capitulating to that, if the government ends up actually implementing a stronger anti-Iran sentiment, I would presume that involves an anti-Iranian policy sentiment as well, which is where the Iraqi government would end up steadily isolating or distancing themselves between policy that Iran would be advocating for. So if that ends up happening, then within the foreseeable future, we could see even more Gulf nations signing normalizing pacts with Israel in order to oust Iran. And in that process, they're going to end up ousting Palestine in a way as well, because Iran is Palestine's biggest funder. So internationally, this conflict has grown to a much more complex status, and it's no longer between Israel and Palestine. It's now become this conflict of Israel versus Palestine, or Israel versus Hamas, or government versus terrorists, or prioritizing ousting a nation that's supporting Palestine in order to protect their own interest. And that's what I feel is what goes ahead and makes this conflict so both unfortunately unique and so unfortunately difficult to reach a conclusion, because politically, I doubt anytime soon that both nations are going to kind of just call it a day and stop fighting, because it's created a paradox for the world and for the Israeli and Palestinian people as well, wherein Israel would go ahead and, according to Netanyahu's policy, push further into the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and they would be using military violence over there. And retaliation, the Palestinian people who are fed up of Israel will end up pushing or supporting Hamas more for more military action against Israel. And it creates this domino effect wherein both nations will be increasing their military operations on the other in retaliation to the other. And I feel that is kind of what makes this conflict particularly difficult to reach consensus on.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the most unfortunate part of this conflict, is that peace has been tried before and it didn't really last for very long. And what doesn't help now is that the governments in charge of each country, regardless of, you know, what we believe in their political programs or agendas, they definitely do not see peace as a viable option anymore. And they believe in a far more confrontational agenda. And you made a good point about how, you know, countries like Iran are definitely influencing the tide of this battle as well. And, you know, calling for some kind of Muslim unity with Palestine, when the United States coming to back Israel, it just seems like as if, while most people obviously want, in the international community, want Israel and Palestine to work together, it just seems like an unfortunate conflict that unless true and credible actions taken, we won't be able to really see a resolution to the conflict, because the governments don't want to cooperate. The international community doesn't necessarily want to act. And as Arnav valiantly mentioned, the people don't necessarily want to cooperate either. They believe themselves that, you know, ultimately we've left the train for peace is left, and it's, you know, it's time now ultimately to decide what to do.
Sure. Right. So I think to end to summarize rather the collective reasons for conflict. Here, as you would have heard us, it's an amalgamation of domestic political forces, social psychology, and the international political arena. And it is characterized by the radicalism of political factions within the country, the kind of environment that the people and citizens are exposed to, and thus the attitudes they form towards the adversary, and the manner in which international alliances and the international system is shaped so as to prevent support from reaching any one country, or rather a lack of support or a lack of credible support for Palestine as a result of alliances and other commitments which prevent them from doing what may be the right thing from a humanitarian perspective versus what is strategic. And therefore, that is another fuel for the humanitarian crisis in places like Gaza and the West Bank. And therefore, it is these crises that fuel extremism in these areas again. And so the cycle again is a vicious one, which is characterized through politics, society, and the international system. So with that, this is a small discussion we had on this. And there's a lot to explore, actually. I think we've gone somewhere, but there are several dimensions of the conflict that I think we all should explore. And then we would encourage the viewers to also, if they have their points and their views, to also bring that out and contact us. I mean, I'll put the email ID of the podcast here. You guys can send in whatever you want and your views and whether you think we missed something or whatever, so that we can keep this going. So yeah, you guys also need to throw some fuel in there. So that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, what we want to ensure is that we're not trying to throw away any political view or opinion. It's just the fact we all ultimately hope for peace in the streets and in this conflict. It's just that unfortunately, at this point of time, with the recent attacks, with Palestine holding up their elections, and more importantly, the lack of the reluctance to actually go for peace between the people itself. Hopefully, obviously, the conflict gets better in the future. And, you know, the more we go on, we can see some peace in this region for sure.
Right. Okay. With that, we'll sign off for this episode, and we'll see you guys in the next episode whenever we do that. All right. See you guys.
See you.